Okay, so anyway, nice to meet you. I'm Latham Boyle. I actually, unfortunately, think I've met almost none of you so far, but I hope I'll meet everybody. I should say right at the outset that I think even by physicist standards, I am like terrible at making eye contact or smiling or doing any of the normal things that humans do to indicate that they're friendly people. But like I don't even with my mother, I don't smile or make eye contact, and I love her very much. But so anyway, I hope you won't be put off by that. If you pass me in the hall and I don't look at you and I'm just frowning, you know, that's nothing. That's probably just me saying hi, you know. So anyway, which is all to say, I hope you'll feel free if you have questions to ask me either during the lecture or after the lecture, or come by my office, or generally don't be put off by the fact that I'm a weirdo. Okay, so. Another thing about questions is that last year I taught this course last year for the first time, and that was my first time teaching, and I discovered something about myself, which is that when people ask me questions, sometimes I will give a decent answer, but then sometimes I am prone to go off on like a very long answer that goes nowhere. And so this year I vowed that when I suspect I'm about to do that, I'm just going to put the question off until the end of the lecture and we can talk afterwards. So if you ask a question and I put it off to the end of lecture, I hope you'll stick around and we can talk about it afterwards. Okay, let's see. I have a couple other like notes of things I'm supposed to say first. So my handwriting is also terrible. Looking at this, these notes are kind of like lists of things that are bad about me, but it wasn't supposed to. So I'm neither left-handed nor right-handed, and so you know there's some people who, most people in the world, they either have very bad handwriting because they write really fast, or they have very good handwriting because they write rather slowly. And then there's a small subset of people who have great handwriting even though they write very fast. And then there's another small subset that you hear less about of people who have very bad handwriting even though they write very slowly, and that's me. So in an attempt to compensate for that, I have written up lecture notes, which I think Anna has already posted the first two lecture notes to the wiki. So anyway, they're basically quite complete. So if you can't read what I'm writing on the board or I'm making a mess of it, hopefully you'll just be able to follow along with the notes, and it also means you don't have to copy everything down. And let's see, is there anything else? Oh yeah. So this also, I mean, this is like a very boring sounding title for this course. I propose that we change this to like cosmology, you know, ruler of the subjects. Because, you know, sometimes you can get the impression from talking to people in other disciplines that cosmology is like an applied subject, that, you know, there's fundamental physics and cosmology is one application of that. But that is backwards. Cosmology is like the ruler of subjects. Everything is cosmology. All subjects are interesting insofar as they exist, insofar as they are either aspects of cosmology or provide tools for answering questions in cosmology. Every branch of human knowledge, you know. But cosmology gave birth to it, and it's like, you know, it's like the mother. It like loves all of its children, but you know, sometimes they need disciplining, and it sets the You know, it decides where they're going that day. And anyway, I think it's important to come at it with the right, you know, right perspective. Yeah, okay. I think those are my administrative announcements. So maybe before jumping into this lecture, let me just give you a brief overview of kind of what the outline is going to be. So basically, today and tomorrow, I'm going to give a review of I'm going to give a sort of a brief review of differential geometry, general relativity, and Yang-Mills theory. So I think that you've met all of these things already in this course. I mean, you already had a general relativity course, for example. So this is just, hopefully this will be helpful. It'll be from a different perspective. It'll be in the notation that, and you know, emphasizing the things that we'll need for the rest of the course. And it's just good to see that, you know, after you spend a lot of time learning something, that in fact, when you go back, it can all be, it can be condensed. Much of what you need to know can be condensed in a few pages and presented in a lecture or two. So after that, okay, so that'll be, let's say, Monday, Tuesday. Then this Wednesday and next Wednesday, I have to be away. So I think probably Ruth Gregory will be doubling up her lectures those 2 days, and then I'll be doubling up my lectures on subsequent Fridays. Did she mention that? She said, okay, yeah. So Wednesday I won't be here. Thursday, if I can stay on schedule, what we'll do is basically there's really only a handful of important solutions in general relativity, but nevertheless, they get confusing if not presented in a unified way. And so in one lecture, I'd just like to, you know, meet the small set of truly important metrics that everyone should know about and understand, you know, what their interrelation is as a stepping stone for that. Well, we'll see. That's a useful first step before going on to cosmology. And so then the Friday lecture then would be really focusing on the metric that is most relevant to us as a first approximation to the space-time in which the cosmological space-time in which we live, the so-called Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. So I guess up here, up here we have every metric you've ever heard of, and then Friday we'll be really getting to know the physics of the FRW metric that describes an expanding space-time, and how particles behave in that metric. And then next week, okay, let me be more schematic about next week rather than spending too much time on it so far in advance. But so next week, the idea is we're roughly speaking, all of this week is geometry, getting to know geometry generally, and then zooming more and more in on the specific case that we're interested in. And next week, we sort of put the matter in. We'll see how matter evolves in a FRW spacetime and how it affects the evolution of the FRW spacetime. And we'll meet some of the most important events in the known events in the history of matter evolution. So there was an early epoch of so-called Big Bang nucleosynthesis, where the light elements in the periodic table were formed, and that's roughly speaking our earliest bit of observational evidence that our expanding universe picture is correct. And then another very early event that we have direct observational access to today is the so-called cosmic microwave background. This is Big Bang nucleosynthesis, cosmic microwave background. So anyway, we'll get to know the essence of these two things. And then toward the end of next week and throughout the third week, the final week, we'll be talking about more questions about how cosmology interacts with unknown fundamental physics, how we invoke currently speculative fundamental physics in an attempt to explain various observational puzzles about the way the universe is today, how future observations future cosmological observations will be able to very likely give us information about physics beyond the current standard model of particle physics. Okay, so these topics here go under the name of dark matter, baryogenesis. So this is sort of the general question of why the universe today has the universe today has an observed asymmetry between matter and antimatter that is not explained by the corresponding known asymmetry in the fundamental laws of nature in the standard model of particle physics. And so it's thought to have a cosmological origin and be a sign of physics beyond the current standard model of particle physics. So we'll talk about that and some sort of the most, maybe the leading proposed interpretation of that. Inflation, this is This is maybe the most popular theory of what happened in the very early universe to create the primordial fluctuations from one point to another that grew into galaxies and people. And let's see, what? Oh, well, maybe if we have, yeah, oh, so dark energy, I'll say something about dark energy. And if we have time, also something about the so-called wave function of the universe. Or in other words, the question of cosmological initial conditions. Okay. So with that, ooh. This is really, I've never, this is like giving a lecture on the Death Star or something like that. This is, I've never in my life thought I would be lecturing at such an awesome blackboard. Okay, so with no further ado, I'm going to spend the rest of this lecture giving a sort of my brief overview of everything you ever need to know about differential geometry. And then next time we'll do general relativity and Yang-Mills theory. Okay, so first, so the basic thing that I want to, say is I want to do it in three steps where first we introduce a manifold, but we have not yet introduced the connection or the metric. Okay, so it's just a manifold, just a sort of floppy manifold without much structure on it. And so we want to see, you know, what mathematical concepts are defined when we just have a manifold but no connection and metric. And then we will introduce the connection, but not yet the metric. So now we have just a manifold with a connection on it. And we want to ask at stage two, you know, what new concepts does that give us? What new aspects of geometry that you're familiar with do you get once you have a connection? And then finally, we will, on top of the connection, also add a metric, g mu nu. And again, we'll see what new concepts ultimately only arise once at this final stage when we've added a metric to the picture. Okay, so before I do that, let me just say a few things about notation. So for partial derivatives, I'm going to not remember to use a single notation, so all of the following things mean the same thing. So df dx alpha, the partial derivative with respect to the alpha's coordinate. Okay, so x alpha, I'll commonly use x to denote the coordinates on some manifold. And the partial derivative with respect to the alpha-th coordinate, I will also write as, I'll sometimes write that as f comma alpha, and alternatively, partial alpha of f. Have you guys, have all of these three notations been used? I thought that was not very unanimous. Did the people who are nodding, do you mean that you've seen those notations before or that they've actually been used in this course? Okay, great. And then if that's true, probably it's also true, but let me just, so the covariant derivative, I'll indicate with a semicolon instead of a comma. V alpha semicolon beta is equivalent to covariant derivative beta of V sub alpha. Another thing is that I'll be taking sort of minus plus 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 sign convention. So in other words, a time-like, the time-like direction in the metric, that component will have a minus sign in front of it. And then the three spatial components of the metric will have a plus sign in front of it. And generally speaking, I guess I should say all my notation agrees with, see, there are a few sign conventions when you're doing general relativity, and people differ on them. But there are three famous references that for what it's worth, in case you want to compare with formulae in there, are using the same conventions that I do. So there's Meisner, Thorne, and Wheeler, a book that I love, but is too long, and Wald. And let's see. Oh yeah, Steven Weinberg's GR book. Anyway, I like all three of those books. Okay. So having said that, let's go back to this three-stage explanation of differential geometry. So, and this is all going to be, I should say, very, very, very informal sort of physicists' level introduction. I should say, by the way, if you want to go on in theoretical physics, probably you're eventually going to want to do a slightly more, study all these things at a slightly more sophisticated, in a more sophisticated mathematical treatment. So Wald's a good place for that. And I also like this book by Arnold has this book on classical mechanics, like mathematical methods of classical physics. That's another very nice book. But anyway, so at my level, so a manifold is some shape with the property that it's some collection of points such that if I zoom in close enough, an n-dimensional manifold, I should say, manifold M, is a collection of points that if I zoom in close enough near any given point, it looks like a little patch of just n-dimensional Euclidean space, Rn. Just for example, the two-dimensional plane, the two-dimensional sphere, and the two-dimensional torus are all two-dimensional manifolds because if this thing went on to infinity in any direction, any sufficiently small patch on any of these three surfaces is indistinguishable from a patch of the two-dimensional plane. Okay, so at this level, what structure do we have on the manifold at this point? Well, first of all, one sort of essential idea in differential geometry is that we want to have geometrical notions that have a meaning that is independent of what coordinates we put on the manifold, but nevertheless, we often need to put down coordinates for practical purposes to describe those objects. But we're free to put down any coordinates we want. So in the vicinity of this point, x, we might take x coordinates, which schematically look like this. Or we might take x twiddle coordinates, which look like this. In the vicinity of that point, there's some, the x twiddle coordinates are the idea is there's some function of the x coordinates. And we can invert that function to get the x coordinates as a function of the x twiddle coordinates. And so then we say that at this point x, at this point on the manifold, which can either be labeled as point x or point x prime, I mean point x twiddle, I should say, that we can have tensors that live at that point on the manifold. And what we mean by a tensor is that it's some object T with a tensor of rank m comma n. It's some object with m upper indices, alpha 1 through alpha m, and n lower indices, beta 1 through beta n, with the property that when I describe this object in two different coordinate systems, the components are related in a particular way. So if I describe this guy in the twiddled coordinate system, its components will be T alpha 1 through alpha m, beta 1 through beta n. They will be related to the components of T in the untwiddled coordinate system by this transformation law, d x twiddle alpha 1 dx gamma 1 dot 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 all the way up to dx alpha m dx gamma m, and then dx delta 1 dx twiddle beta 1 dx delta n dx twiddle beta n, and then times t gamma 1 through gamma m delta 1 through delta n. Okay, and so if you, that's the general law, it's maybe worth just looking at the case where the special case, so the special case where you have an object with just one upper index and no lower indices, that's a so-called contravariant vector. And in general, the upper indices are called contravariant indices. And a tensor with just one lower index and no upper indices is called a covariant vector. And again, in general, these lower indices are all called covariant indices. And you know, just to maybe, I gave the general case first, but it's worth saying, where did these transformation laws come from? Well, one way to say it is just intuitively, if we want, let's imagine there's some function near this point x on the manifold. So over every point in the vicinity of that, over every point in the vicinity of this central point x, the function has some value, and we want to define the directional derivative of that function at this point. So we want to say, you know, we want to have some notion of what is the derivative of this function in this direction. I'm drawing an arrow. I don't know if you can see that. So in the x coordinates, we would describe that directional derivative operator as some linear combination of the derivative operators in each of the different coordinate directions. Okay, and the coefficients in that linear combination are some vector v sub alpha. Or we could describe this same directional derivative operator in the twiddled coordinates, in which case it would look like this. But the point is, we want this to mean the same thing in either coordinate system. And so we can use the chain rule here. So, you know, d alpha, again, that just means d dx alpha. And by the chain rule, that's dx twiddle beta dx alpha d d x twiddle beta. Okay, so in other words, this is equal to v alpha dx twiddle beta dx alpha d twiddle beta. Okay, let me change the name of this index to beta. So anyway, my point is that comparing these two expressions and requiring them to be the same thing, we see that this coefficient vector had better be the same as this coefficient vector. And so we learn that the transformation law for a contravariant vector, by just comparing these two expressions, is that v sub beta twiddle is equal to this guy, right? Which is the special case of this formula when you just have one upper index and no lower indices. And similarly, so in other words, intuitively you should think of a contravariant vector as a directional derivative. And its transformation law is just what it has to be in order for that directional derivative operator to have a meaning independent of what coordinate systems you write down, consistent with the chain rule, consistent with the chain rule, you know, always being true. And similarly, a covariant vector, you can think of that as as we imagine we have some little differential, some little, we move from this point to some infinitesimally nearby point, and we want to describe the little differential coordinate change that takes us from this point to this point. Well, in one coordinate system, we would write that as like this, where again, this covariant vector is now just the set of coefficients in the linear combination of the different individual coordinate changes required to take me to these between these two nearby points. And then in the other coordinate system, that would look like v twiddle alpha, or let me use betas, v twiddle beta, dx twiddle beta. And again, if I use the chain rule here to rewrite dx alpha as partial x alpha, partial x twiddle beta, dx twiddle beta, and then compare these two expressions, I get that v twiddle sub beta is equal to dx alpha dx twiddle sub beta v sub alpha. Is it clear what the pattern is that if I'm trying to get the tensorial object in the twiddled coordinates, every time I have a upper index appearing here, it should also appear on top here with a twiddle, since I'm going into the twiddled coordinates. Every time I'm trying to convert one of these lower indices, I should have a factor that has beta, that has the corresponding index in the denominator, and again with a twiddle, if that's the direction that I'm going. Okay. So I apologize if that was slow for anybody. My general impression from last year is that there was different people have seen a lot of different range of stuff, and some people have had whole courses in general relativity, and so I apologize to those people, but you won't be mortally wounded. It'll all go fast, and it'll be good. At worst, you'll be an hour older, and you'll have gotten so bored that you think of something great. Okay. So another thing is that my wife's father. My wife is from the Soviet Union, and her father is a compendium of Russian jokes. And he says that every time I fear that I've caused the audience to glaze over, that I should tell one of his jokes. So I should say that these have their own, you know, I don't know. I used to not think these were. These are not objectively. These are. I used to not think these were funny, and then they just kind of grew on me. But so, well, anyway, here. So a man is a man gets on a train and he sits down, and the person across from him, the second man, is he peels a banana and he pours some salt on it, and then he throws it out the window, and the first man sort of doesn't say anything, and then the second guy does this again, and then again, and the first guy says, what are you doing? And the second man says, oh, I'm so sorry. I just assumed that both of us didn't like salty bananas. Anyway. Okay, so the next thing I was going to say, let's see, maybe I'll... I really didn't use that first board as much as I should have. Okay. Okay, so basically, to make a long story short, what we have when we just have a manifold, but we don't yet have a connection, we don't yet have a metric, is, well, we have some space that looks like Rn locally, and we have the notion of tensors living at each point on that space, but we don't yet have a lot of the other things that you associate with geometry, and in particular, we don't yet have any relationship between, so there's some, you know, there's some, at this point on the manifold, there is a vector space in which there's a little vector space that lives here, and you can have little contravariant vectors living there. And then at some other point on the manifold, there is some other contravariant vector space, and you can have contravariant vectors living there. But at the moment, we don't have any relationship between these two, between those two vector spaces at different points on the manifold. For example, we can't say whether a vector here is parallel to a vector here or perpendicular, or we have no notion of that. We don't have any notion of whether the vectors here are longer or shorter than the vectors over here. Okay, and so in particular, what we don't yet have is a notion of the derivative of a vector from one point to another, the derivative of a tensor as you move from one point to another on a manifold. So to get that, that leads us to introduce a connection as follows. So, you know, we want, there's going to be this idea, especially in general relativity, there's going to be this idea that anything that is locally observable at a point, you know, Einstein taught us to expect that thing had better be a tensor of some sort. But a lot of the things that we, you know, measure in physics are derivative quantities. So we want somehow to be able to take derivatives and still have the object be a tensor, behave like a tensor after differentiation. So, but if we just take the ordinary derivative, that doesn't work. So to give an example, So let's say we have some contravariant vector field. So now there's a little contravariant vector at every point on the manifold. And we just try to take the partial derivative of that thing. So this thing, if it was a tensor, it would transform like an object with one lower index and one upper index. But it doesn't do that, right? Because, if I transform to a new coordinate system, if I transform V, then in the new coordinate system, according to that transformation law, V transforms like that. V sub alpha transforms like that. But now when I act with this partial derivative, as usual, a partial derivative acting on two factors produces two terms, one where it operates on each of these guys. So in other words, I get one term that looks like Let me also use the chain rule to. I rewrote V, but I should have also rewritten. I should have also used the chain rule to convert this guy into twiddled coordinates. So, chain rule would say dx twiddle delta dx beta partial x twiddle delta and then all of the stuff inside parentheses. And so my point is that when we act, we get one term where the partial derivative passes through this factor and acts on this guy, and that's the term we want. So that term looks like and so this is exactly the right transformation law if this thing were a tensor, but we get the second term, which comes from this guy acting on this first factor, and I won't write it out, but you can see that it will involve there will be no derivative acting on v twiddle, and there will be a second derivative here. It'll be some term that contains d squared x alpha dx twiddle gamma, dx twiddle delta, times b twiddle gamma, and then this times this factor, which I won't write. But the point is, this spoils the tensorial nature of the transformation law. So this thing is not a tensor, in other words. It would have been a tensor if it was just equal to this. So the solution is to define a new slightly modified derivative, the covariant derivative, which is a partial derivative plus an extra, which is a partial derivative plus an extra piece that involves the so-called connection gamma, capital gamma. That acts multiplicatively on V, and so this is somehow some little extra rotation that we're allowing ourselves the freedom to apply to the vector V when we differentiate it, and we want to choose this extra rotation in just such a way as to make this thing transform like a tensor, and so a little exercise that is good to do is to check that the right transformation law, if you ask how should this thing transform precisely so as to subtract off this term, the answer is that you get the rule for the transformation law of a connection. A connection gamma does not transform like a tensor. Instead, it transforms as follows. So first, there's a term that looks just like a tensor transformation law. So in other words, if this was a tensor, it would transform like but then we add an extra bit here, which is precisely designed to kill this term. And it looks like what fraction of the time am I standing in front of what I'm writing so you can't see it? A large fraction. Admit it. I just realized it. Can you? When? 1/5? That's lower than I had. Okay, great. That's pretty good. I'll accept that fraction. So we just introduce an object on the manifold that is defined to transform this way. And once we've done that, we can define a sensible derivative operator, covariant derivative operator on the manifold. And More generally, so I've written down the full transformation. You know, if you, more generally, this covariant derivative operator, you can now act on a general tensor. And I won't write down the full transformation law just to not waste time. But sorry?
In second term of gamma transformation, be gamma as the last term.
There's no multiplicative term in gamma in the second term.
Well, then how do the indexes?
So we have an alpha, beta, gamma index here. And so here we have, we still have to have the alpha, beta, gamma index uncontracted. And then we've introduced three new indices in this term, mu, nu, rho, which all have to get soaked up by the three indices here. But here, in addition to alpha, beta, gamma, we just have a mu here and a mu here that they soak each other up. These two indices are the same. I don't know, my handwriting. What? I actually don't think so. I think what happens, let me see. I don't think that's right. I know you see, the thing is, you know, you can invert, you can all, see, I think you're thinking of if I had written
if you added it to the term, then it
doesn't answer that. That's true. Nevertheless, somehow I think that's, yeah. Oh yeah. That's exactly right. I switched which direction I was going. That's right. So in other words, let's change. Okay, exercise for the reader to check whether this is a plus or a minus sign. I believe it's a plus sign, but I'm gonna classify this as one of those things where if I check it now, I'll spend too much time. But that's a great exercise to check which sign is necessary. I think I have this expression deep in my heart. I believe the sign is right. I can't resist looking at it now. No, I can resist looking at it now. I can resist. Oh, I was going to say, so the general action on a general tensor, if I take the covariant derivative, basically, so I get the first term is just an ordinary partial derivative. And then for each upper index, I get a term like, so corresponding to the ith index here, I get a term that's like plus gamma mu alpha I gamma I and T alpha 1 gamma I alpha M. So I get in other words M terms like this, one for each of the M upper indices, and each of those come with a plus sign. And then for each of the N lower indices, I get a term like minus gamma mu minus gamma mu, let's say delta I beta I T alpha 1 Okay, so I now have a derivative operator that I can use to act on any tensor field, according to this algorithm. And the resulting thing will still be a tensor, just with one more lower index. Okay? This is going to bother me for the rest of the lecture. Okay, anyway. So now that I've done that, suddenly I've established. So now suppose I have some tensor field, let's say some vector field. So I have a little contravariant vector at every point on the manifold, a contravariant vector field. And in particular, I have its value here and I have its value here. And now I supply a curve. I have the value of this vector at point A, point B, and everywhere in between. And I supply a curve connecting point A to point B. Well, let's say that curve is x mu of tau. Then I can ask whether at every value, what I mean to say is, so this guy has, this curve has a tangent vector at every point, which is dx mu d tau. And if at every, if as I move along that curve, the directional derivative along that curve, the directional covariant derivative, u mu partial mu v alpha is equal to zero, then I say that the vector field v alpha is parallel transported along this curve from A to B. Okay? So in other words, and more generally, if I have the directional derivative of any tensor field, if it vanishes along that curve, I say that this tensor field is parallel transported from A to B. And so now, in other words, now that I've supplied a connection, or now that I've been able to define a covariant derivative on the manifold, suddenly I've established a way to connect the vector spaces that live at A to the vector spaces that live at B. If I give you the connection and a curve connecting those two points, now there's a notion of whether the vectors that live here or the tensors that live here are parallel to the ones that live here. Okay, so that's one thing you get with a connection. Now, another thing you get is, well, so to draw my manifold again. So of all the various curves that I can draw that connect points A and B, once I've introduced a connection, some of those curves will be special in the sense that if I take this curve is x mu as a function of tau, the parameter along the curve, and if I take the tangent vector at any point on the curve, I can ask whether the tangent vector itself is parallel transported along the curve. So in other words, if u mu del mu of u nu is equal to zero, then the tangent vector is parallel transported along the curve. A special curve with a curve that has that special property is a geodesic. Okay, so a geodesic is another example of a concept that you may be familiar with thinking of it in a metric sense as some sort of curve of shortest length or extremal length, but it actually appears already. When the manifold is endowed with a connection before the metric is present. So let's see, what else did I want to say about this? So I guess another thing that you get as soon as you have a connection is is a notion of curvature. Once you have a connection, but before you have a metric on the manifold, you have a notion of curvature on the manifold because partial derivatives commute, right? On partial derivatives acting on more or less anything commute with one another. But covariant derivatives do not commute. So if you take the commutator of two covariant derivatives and act, for example, on if you act on a scalar, a tensor with no indices, then you'll find that these two things commute. But as soon as you act on something that that has indices, that is a non-trivial tensor, you'll find that it does not commute. And so in particular, let me change these two. So let's take the commutator of del sub gamma, del sub delta, acting on v sub alpha. You'll find that it doesn't commute. And the curvature, you can think of the curvature as measuring the failure of two covariant derivatives to commute when acting on a tensor. Okay, so the Riemann curvature tensor can be defined by this formula. Okay, it's the proportionality tensor that measures the failure of these two derivatives to commute. And if you just take, if you just expand this out, if you just use our formula for converting this formula for converting the covariant derivative into a partial derivative plus connections, you just expand out this side, then you'll find this famous expression for the Riemann tensor in terms of the Christoffel symbol. So you'll just so I leave this as an exercise. In fact, probably this is a good either tutorial problem or homework problem to do once in your life. It's not to do once in your life makes it sound like it's hard and gory, but it's actually not. I didn't want to. I would never. But to make a long story short, I know this formula, but I recommend not memorizing this formula. But anyway, my point is just that it has the important takeaway point is that you expand out this side, compare the two sides, you find you get an expression which has two terms. The first two terms have opposite signs and have one factor are linear in gamma, but differentiated. And the second two terms, again, have opposite signs but are quadratic in gamma with no differentiation. Okay, and I guess maybe the one other thing that we get before introducing the metric that'll be important for us is this guy with four indices is the so-called Riemann tensor. But then we can contract these two indices. In other words, I should have said when I was talking about notation at the beginning, you guys have also seen the Einstein summation convention where whenever you have two upper and lower, okay, yeah. Okay, so if I set these two guys equal and sum, I get a new object that only has two indices. This thing is the so-called Ricci tensor. And the Ricci tensor will encounter, the Ricci tensor only has two indices. It's only a 2x2 matrix. So it encodes a lot less information than the full Riemann tensor, which encodes essentially everything about the curvature of a space-time. But the Ricci tensor is the thing that will appear in vacuum. The Einstein equations for general relativity we'll see in the case where the space-time is just vacuum, where there's no matter present, just reduced to saying that the Ricci tensor vanishes. These are, R alpha beta is equal to 0. are the vacuum Einstein equations for general relativity. Okay, and so now let's finally introduce the metric and see what it gives us. Okay, so the metric is some field on the manifold. It's a 2x2, it's a rank 2 tensor. It's, in other words, it's basically a 2x2 symmetric matrix at every defined at every point on the manifold. Well, since it's a 2x2 matrix, it can have a 2x2 inverse matrix, which is how we define G with upper indices. And okay, so the new things that we have once we have a metric living everywhere on the manifold, well, we can take indices on tensors and raise them and lower them. So for example, if we have an upper index on V and we want to make an object with a lower index, we can lower it by applying the metric. Or if we have an object with a lower index and we want to raise that index, we can apply the inverse metric, and more generally we can do this as much as we want to any tensor with any number of indices. We now have a notion of an inner product at point A. There's some vector space that lives at that point, but so far we haven't had any notion of, if we have two contravariant vectors at this point, what is their inner product with one another, or what is the inner product of any one of these vectors with itself? So in other words, what are the lengths of the vectors? So now we can do that. You know, if we have V alpha and U beta are two contravariant vectors, then we have this well-defined inner product at that point. And similarly, you know, yeah, it's obvious, I guess, that we can use the inverse matrix to take the inner product of two covariant vectors. Another thing we can do now is we can, since this index was already up and this index was already down, we were able to contract them even though we didn't have a metric yet. But then we were left with an object with two lower indices that until we have a metric, we have no means of contracting. But now that we have a metric tensor, we can contract these two indices and get the so-called Ricci scalar. So for the first time, we have a notion of a measure of the curvature at a given point that is, you know, invariant under changes of coordinates. And again, this guy will play an important role in general relativity. Basically, the part of the term in the action that is responsible for generating Einstein's equations is just basically the integral over the manifold of the Ricci scalar. So this thing is, yeah, so this plays that important role. What else do we have? So we also have, I guess, so we also can define the length of a curve. We hadn't, until we introduced the metric, there was no notion of how long a curve was. But now, so now if we have a curve, x mu of t, x mu of tau, at any given point there is a so-called line element. We can take a little differential along dx mu along this curve, and take its inner product with itself using the metric to find the squared distance of that little differential element dx mu, and then we can just integrate that up to get the length of the curve. So the length of the curve gamma here is just the integral from A to B of ds, of the square root of this thing. And so that leads us to a new special type of curve. For most curves, if we take the length of the curve, and then we make a little infinitesimal variation in the curve, the length of the curve will vary, will change to first order in that variation. But for a certain special subset of curves, the length of the curve will not vary to first order. The first order variation in the length under an infinitesimal variation of the curve will vanish. And that special class of curve, we can again call a geodesic, because it turns out that it is equivalent to our previous notion of geodesic. And oops, I forgot. So I should have, before I said that, I should have said another thing that we get once we get a metric is that, so far we've said, we start with a manifold. Now we write down some connection, gamma, alpha, beta, gamma. And then we just add some on top of that, some symmetric rank 2 tensor G mu nu, the metric. But in fact, as soon as we've added the metric, it's no longer the case that every connection is just as good. There is a special connection now, namely the connection such that the covariant derivative of G mu nu vanishes. And so something that you will explore in the tutorial is okay. So this condition requiring that requiring that the metric be essentially everywhere parallel to itself all over the manifold, that its covariant derivative everywhere vanishes, implies that there is this preferred connection, which is given by the famous Christoffel formula, which again, this is an exercise that I'll leave to the tutorial. But so the point is, given the metric, there's this formula that you can use to calculate the preferred connection, the so-called Levi-Civita connection. And so now that I have said that, assuming that once we introduce the metric, we also take the preferred connection with respect to that metric, we use this Levi-Civita connection, then the thing that I said here is true, that these two different definitions of a geodesic, a curve that extremizes or that is, that not extremizes, a curve whose length is, the variation in its length vanishes to first order in the variation, that definition of geodesic becomes equivalent to this previous definition of a geodesic as a curve that parallel transports its own tangent vector. Okay, and maybe one last, since I'm almost out of time, but we're really right at the end of what I wanted to say. One of the things that's nice about this new metric definition of a geodesic is that it gives a more convenient way, usually, to calculate the geodesic equation, the differential equation governing this curve, because, well, you know, this all sounds familiar. The idea that the length of this curve, if it's a geodesic, vanishes to first order in variations of the curve, sounds a lot like the Hamilton and Lagrange formulation of classical mechanics, where the action among all possible trajectories through configuration space, the solution of the classical equations of motion is the one such that if you calculate the action along that curve and then vary it infinitesimally, the first order variation, the variation in the action vanishes to first order in variation of the curve. They're clearly apart from changing names, it's the same problem. It's a calculus of variations problem. And so what you can show is that if you take this dude if you take this line element and convert it into a, you know, just sort of formally treat it as a Lagrangian by saying, so in other words, just like an ordinary Lagrangian depends on various q's, the various coordinates on configuration space, and their time derivatives. So L depends on Q and Q dot. This Lagrangian depends on the various X's, the various coordinates. They appear because G mu nu is a function of them. So it depends on X and its derivatives. X dot means dx d tau. So if I take this Lagrangian and vary with respect to X, just like I do here, just like I get the Euler Lagrange equations just like the classical equations of motion are given by the Euler Lagrange equations derived from this Lagrangian, the geodesic equation is in exactly the same way derived as the Euler Lagrange equations corresponding to this Lagrangian. That usually is the most convenient way to get the explicit geodesic equations for a given metric. Okay, I think that's all I wanted to say. That's everything you ever need to know about differential geometry, as far as I am concerned. Anything else you ever know about differential geometry is your business. And next time we'll be doing another review lecture, basically a review of general relativity and Yang-Mills theory, where it's going to be, I should say, it's where this might have seemed like a pedantic distinction, you know, this process of introducing differential geometry by first introducing the manifold and then the connection and then the metric. When at the end of the day, in general relativity, we use all three together. One useful thing will appear next time, where you know general relativity and Yang-Mills theory are very closely related to one another. But the Yang-Mills field is a connection. It's analogous to our capital gamma. The field strength F mu nu associated with that Yang-Mills field is like the curvature of this connection. And so for understanding, you know, the relationship between general relativity and Yang-Mills theory, it is very useful to keep separate what aspects of geometry are present before versus after the metric is introduced. Because in Yang-Mills theory, you don't need, you do not ever reach that stage of introducing a metric on the space whose connection is the gauge field A mu. All right. Are there any questions about any of that? Or I should say, I should stop because I ran over by 5 minutes. Anyway, so that's it. If you have any questions, maybe we can talk afterwards.